Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith, and today I'm honoured to be joined by the excellent cultural commentator, Lola Salem. Lola, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for inviting me, Ben.
Thank you for coming. Absolutely. And today I'd like to discuss two of your recent pieces for The Critic magazine. The first of them was titled Gender Gymnastics, and it addressed the gender debate and more specifically the role that politicians who are women have had to play in it. So Nicola Sturgeon, also members of the Labour Party. We can also think, if we kind of extend the issue of Ardern in New Zealand, many others. You write in your piece, women have an important role to play in this epistemological revolution. It is only through their marketed consent and their permissive nods that the cultural revolution continues. So how would you determine the kind of specific role that women politicians have had to play?
I guess it's a role that has evolved as obviously the feminist movement itself has evolved and as the cause has shifted, sometimes radically, sometimes more kind of slowly and more, in more perfect manners perhaps. But at the moment, the piece was reacting to all of these people we have around us. You talked about a few figures already, who are really buying into this idea that women are here to serve things, ideas, other people who are actually actively working against them. And that was the reaction that led me to write that piece in the first instance. And of course, I wove that with at least one personal anecdote and story, which I think was illustrating this perfectly, and we can talk about it perhaps later. But that was the reaction, and I think this is the matter nowadays with female in politics is that they are selling themselves, hence why it is definitely a problem for their political careers to entangle their political survival to that kind of cause. But also for others, because of course they bring all of the other female politics with them, and saying basically you need to take a stance between for or against those topics, where actually women should be able to choose to talk about it or not to talk about it. And that was the thing that struck me the most is that Keir Starmer himself, who said everything in his contrary almost on those matters of transgender issues or whatever, is not at all at risk to be put aside, to be sidelined in the way that some other colleagues in his own party or other women across the political spectrum definitely are. I would say a limit case to all of that, because I thought, not everyone falls very easily into categories, but a limit case could be Mordaunt. She was very much pro-trans ideology before, and then she completely flipped her vest, Penny, when she tried to run as PM. And she, on the contrary, she endorsed yet another mask, but then we can talk about how perhaps some politicians, male and female alike, can be just very, very at ease with using different masks and being able to transmogrify themselves as they want. And she just endorsed, completely out of the blue, I thought, this kind of very traditional figure of standing against the nonsense of the menace, which itself she completely enabled throughout her, can't remember if it's years or months now, in a lifetime of conservative politician career, but for the time that she was as a Minister for Women's Rights or something like this, she completely enabled the very ideology that then suddenly she said she was against. And I don't think it cost her too much. So perhaps she's a limit case of all of that. But if you look at indeed the way that female politicians in particular are exposed to those ideas, I think it's mostly at their detriment. And again, whether they are for or against.
Yeah, I mean, quite soon after your piece, Nicola Sturgeon stepped down from her role as First Minister in Scotland. And I think we can say perhaps it was in part as a result of the position that she had taken on trans prisoners, in women's prisons. Why do you think this case became such a lightning rod for controversy?
That's a good question. I think she's always been somehow a divisive figure. But when you look at how people in Scotland side or not with her, she does have a lot of momentum. So she's someone in Scotland respected, for better or for worse. And I think part of the issue with her in particular was perhaps less even the fact that she was a female politician or anything related to those ideologies or ideas, but just because her main cause of the SNP is very clear, very well defined, and it's independence, right? So you have to follow that one path, for better or for worse. And somehow she successfully weakened that one ultimate goal by trading a very dangerous line, again, there's this path with that new form of ideology, which is itself kind of one goal organized, right? It's like one thing that needs to be pursued. And somehow, perhaps you can make the argument that if you have two main huge ideologies like this, which are focused on one very specific aim or goal, perhaps one is going to eat or cannibalize the other. Perhaps that's the truth. And that can be true for as many one goal ideology as there is, perhaps. But it's been interesting to see that the gender one has completely taken over, at least in her case, the independence one, which if we look at history, is a much longer, almost more traditional one to embrace. We can see it happening throughout the world, whether I take Corsica, for example, Catalonia. I mean, there are plenty of other regions in the world that definitely endorse the same kind of claims like that. And you could say, well, therefore, because it's something that echoes so well with other people's wishes, temperaments, or whatever across the world, it should have momentum. And on the contrary, her endorsement, which, I mean, again, in relative terms in politics, is it long or not long? I'm not sure. But it's been quite some years that she's been very adamant, and her party with her, what is majority of her party on those gender ideology lines, has completely cannibalized this one, which has been the very flame of the movement from the start. It's literally the DNA. That begs lots of questions. And actually, I just made the comparison with Barcelona. Barcelona, Catalonia, but Barcelona in particular is a high place for gender ideology in Europe, and especially Spain. And it would be interesting, I'm not as knowledgeable on politics there that I am perhaps in the UK or France, but it would be interesting to see if the nationalist or independence cause is also as much as a risk because of gender ideology being taken on board by the same partisan of independence. So I would need to make a bit more research on this. But it's telling, and she's a strong figure who obviously has said a lot of various different things and can be divisive. And at some point, I think the thing that kind of, you know, where the penny drops, at least for me, and I expect for a lot of others, is that you cannot lie to people to the point that you think a rapist, male-bodied, male-born, well, however you want to call it, is put in a female prison, and that's fine, because ultimately that's how they feel, how they identify it, that matters. It's like, you know, we can make a lot of room for nuance and a lot of room for trying to settle as much disagreements as we can. But when there is such an obvious risk of pure violence, it goes so much against what supposedly feminism or this type of social movements are in favor of, which is lesser violence, policing men in particular, making sure that women and people who are institutions of weaknesses or whatever are prioritized and cared for. It goes so much even against that, that I don't think it was possible for her to stand, to just stay in her position. And thank God, to be honest. Now the question is, are we just managing decline somehow? And are we just seeing cases after cases, just the way that reality is being pushed to the last boundaries? And this is one boundary for now, and perhaps later when the same situation arises, people will be more accustomed to the situation. So perhaps we'll keep male rapists in female prisons. I don't know. But nowadays, that's where reality is kind of a shock for people. And it's like, no, we definitely just can't do that. And of course, as long as you pull on one thread, the rest of the tapestry kind of breaks down, basically.
Yeah, you have a very nice line in the conclusion of your piece where you say, no one has the right to dismantle reality. Yeah. Do you think there's maybe a danger for, I'm slightly putting in air quotes because I'm not 100% sure what it means, so I'll say gender critical people.
Yeah.
Of, you know, focusing on these individual controversies and the individual premises of that argument, you know, women's sports, women's prisons, mm-hmm. when maybe we should be taking more of a holistic approach and saying it's not just a matter of these individual cases, it's a matter of the actual epistemological principle involved.
Yeah, I think so. I think obviously, you know, I'm still somehow an academic, perhaps for not too long, but so back and forth into granular detail or more kind of holistic definitely is the way to go. And you can't address specifics if you don't understand the kind of principles from which they derive. So I would agree with you. And part of my problem with not all of the gender critical movement, and I think it's actually a more diverse movement than perhaps some people think it is, it's just that the people who base it on extremely atheistic kind of premises, or at least are extremely adamant against any other way to think than perhaps even just the very basic form of feminism, somehow still very liberal feminism they've been fed as young girls, or, you know, this doesn't work for me. And you need to realize that some of the principles that you're so keen to preserve and make survive are actually part of the problem, and that we need to kind of find other premises or find at least critical ways to see how the feminist movement, or plural, I think that there's been several and there's definitely been different ideas intertwined with it, has been part of the problem. And I think some of those gender radical, not all of them, are not willing or just don't want, I don't know if it's not wanting or just unable to see, and it doesn't matter, to be honest, that's a discussion, ongoing discussion, and there is nothing judgmental on my part, at least. There are plenty of people who either are parallel to those movements or somehow intertwined to those movements, who are very much able to address, I think, those kind of very first epistemological critiques. I don't know if herself, she would characterize herself as a gender critical person, but Mary Harrington definitely is doing a fabulous, fabulous work on all of this. Louise Perry, same thing. So there are plenty of women who are starting, or more than starting, to be honest, to give them full credit. They are expressing new forms of disagreements and critiques that indeed have this kind of holistic approach and go back to the sources to address where the roots, again, singular, plural, of the problem are. And indeed, the I think perhaps the paradox in seeing women, as I was arguing in the piece, being actually the first to sabotage themselves, to self-sabotage, is because they are, some of them are just absolutely unable to understand the roots of the problem at play in their feminist beliefs. The fact that, you know, you need to be, you need to fight for women's rights, fine, fair enough. But then how does that end up being, well, that you need to fight for anyone who is in a situation of weakness or whatever? Already not clear for me. I think any politician should have this duty anyway, but fine. And then why it is that now we have, you know, we see those women being so adamant about, oh, it is my duty, my sacred duty, to fight for the men who actually make a parody of my sex, because actually sex doesn't exist and biology doesn't exist and it's a myth. It's like we've jumped so far, there's been such a leap into kind of rational-ish steps towards some new causes or whatever, to something completely out of this world and definitely not connected to reality, that surely there is something much, much deeper ingrained in all of that that allows us this to happen. It doesn't always have to be logical, by the way. I think I mentioned The Captive Mind, for example, which is a direct kind of wink to Czesław Miłosz, and sorry for all of the Polish people perhaps, or people who know Polish better than I do. I can't pronounce his name properly, but Czesław Miłosz wrote, I think, in 1953 or something like this, the Captive Mind, and it's all about how intellectuals during under communism are self, at first kind of thinking that they are on top of their own, the way that brains kind of submit to the regimes without submitting, and they think they can be the master of both worlds, kind of within the system, with whilst being critical of that system. And of course, and he uses four very specific examples, all lettered after, all named after letters, I think. But of course, in each of those very specific, and I think real cases, people just completely succumb to their own self-sabotage again. And I think that's also what's happening with perhaps some women who think, well, I kind of see there is something a bit weird, and I kind of see there is something that just doesn't make quite sense, but actually either they persuade themselves that it's for the greater good, probably, or they persuade themselves that it's for their best political interest. But all of that to say, it's not always logic, as in like pure rational logic, that enters into the whole plate. It's also emotions. It's also just kind of a sense. Many women part of, you know, speak of a sense of a sacred duty, whatever. And it's not always rational logics that that just coordinate all of this. And I think that's also something that gender critical women, or at least some feminists are, and progressive altogether, are wrong about, is that and even the critiques of them. We were talking just before we recorded about Ted Cruz and work. Like, there are plenty of conservative critiques who just don't understand that it's not always on the level of pure logics that you can address those problems. There's something a bit more complex about it.
Yeah, absolutely. We often make fun as people of the right of this term intersectionality. Mm. And I mean, as a principle of politics, I think it's perfectly fair that we make fun of it. But I think it does refer to a kind of psychological impulse. You're right. I was writing in a piece about a poll which showed that more women than men support the idea of trans people in women's prisons, which seems kind of inexplicable. But I think there's a lot to what you said about how when people see themselves as put upon, rightly sometimes or wrongly, they have this level of empathy towards other people they see as put upon, which, I mean, for many people, that extends to criminals themselves. So it's difficult to unpack all of those psychological underpinnings, but it can be very damaging to oneself. You did, as you mentioned, you had this wonderful personal anecdote in your piece. You'll do a much better job of telling it than I would. So can you tell me what it was?
I was something like 8 months pregnant, so in Oxford, and I think that was towards the end of one of the terms. So, you know, things can be very dense during term time, and towards the end, you just want to breathe and do things in general that you don't have the time to do. So at that moment, I, being very pregnant, having done a lot of work or whatever, I thought, I'm gonna treat myself. No sense of the word. I'm going to treat myself, and I'm going to go to one of those, you know, workshops or whatever type of meetings that colleges offer. And I never go there. I never go there because I know what's going to be said. Or to be honest, I was trying to be humble at the time. I thought, perhaps I always think I'm going to know what they're going to say, and I need to be more humble and say, no, perhaps I just don't know. You know, perhaps I need to open up, and I need to be actually more open and agreeable to, you know, to thoughts that I disagree with, which, to be honest, has always been my thinking anyway in Oxford. So I thought, now is the right time to just expose myself to, you know, people who think differently, whatever. And I just went there, and I knew I made somehow a mistake literally in the five first minutes. So when, after people, you know, had tea, whatever, and of course everyone was kind. Of course everyone is kind. Of course everyone is very nice and agreeable and whatever. But then you're asked to state your pronouns. And there is one thing that I swore to myself, which is, you know, the kind of hard lines that you just don't, like the Rubicon, right? You just don't want to cross, because you betray yourself in a very profound manner. And I don't have anything with people who want to say their pronouns. I do think they participate in the problem, but whatever, if they want to do it, that's, you know, that's their freedom, that's their right. And I just didn't want to. So I thought, okay, you have two choices. You either step out now, and obviously that's not going to be great, or the equivalent would be, sorry, I just don't want to state my pronouns, but just being said very explicitly. And again, that would state, you know, that would put the entire room against me anyway. And there was a fairly long discussion, I think 2 hours or something like this. So I thought, perhaps those options are not the best one. So the other one was to laugh it off, and, you know, that's put actually people in a better mood without betraying myself. And that's why I did. So the start of that meeting, people going round, I was almost one of the last ones, which I guess made things a bit easier. So I said that my pronouns were 8 months pregnant, and genuinely everyone laughed. So I thought, I did it. I got out of a situation that was not easy for me. People were either kind enough to think, or perhaps she didn't want to, but, you know, she's been playing along, or they didn't see anything, which perhaps was even better. and the discussion continued. Actually, we can even talk about the discussion if that is of interest, because the topic was about women leadership in academia. So problems of representation, again, you know, how much women do we have who lead or whatever. And the funny thing about all of that is that right after everyone gave their pronouns and we started properly the conversation, the first thing that I think the main organizer or the main speaker said immediately, both of them together agreeing, was there is no problem. There is not such problem. We've done it. Like, well done us, and patting everyone in the back, which was crazy to me. It was like, well, we've kind of answered the topic of the discussion in the first 10 seconds. What was the point of the discussion then? You know, just already a bit out of this world. And funnily enough, when we continued anyway talking about how it is to be, I guess, a woman in academia, no one was talking about, well, for example, the situation in which I was, which was, you know, being a pregnant or single mother in academia. And when I was the one asking those questions, the resistance towards those topics was actually interesting. Not a full resistance, but rather, you know, kind of a type of discourse I think I would have expected from the mouth of actually a man in banking, let's say from the 90s, saying, well, you have to make a choice. You can't have it all. And on the contrary, nowadays in banking, finance, in consultancy, if you go in those domains and you're, again, either single mother as I am, or, you know, pregnant or whatever, they are able to make you feel welcome, to make sure that you are cared for, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the discourse I had on that day for academy is that, no, you can't, and you'll have to wait, and you have to make a choice between that family life and that work life, which I thought was crazy. Literally, I thought that was like, well, aren't we here to talk about representation of women, and women come with a biology, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that's the topic we can dive in later if you want. And the anecdote that I recall in the article is that I thought that everything went fine on the day of the meeting. And actually, on the day I gave birth, I received an email that was about how transphobic the whole thing had been, how, you know, I should realize and accept the problems that were embedded in stating what I stated. And the funny thing is that, and also the email was with a lot of links, you know, YouTube or articles embedded into it that would help me to better understand with, you know, fact and science. And everything I would read was just completely ridiculous in terms of anecdotal evidence, complete ideological discourse, et cetera, et cetera. But organized in such a fashion that it would be pressuring me to, you know, to accept and to be afraid, probably, I assume. I never replied. I thought that was not worth my time, and also I literally just gave birth. and the funny thing is that if you really look at it from, again, a completely non-emotional lens, if I state 8 months pregnant, it's a question of biology, but we are being told again and again, gender and sex is not the same, you know, you can decide a gender ideology or whatever. I could have been 8 months pregnant and be a man, for example, a trans man or whatever, and of course this was not presumed as a possibility by those people. They could have very much think so. Oh, well, she's just stated her, you know, biological state, but actually she can identify differently. Of course not, because the game is so painfully obvious that if you derive from it too much, or even so slightly, it's like a flag planted on your head immediately, right? And you're flagging to others that you've understood the game and you just don't want to play it. And that's the tricky part for I think mostly women. I really can't think of the equivalent for position men, for example, who are always put on the spotlights about that game in a way that men really aren't. And so I remember, for example, you know, Corbyn, who was, I think, the first Labour leader to put his pronouns in his Twitter bio or something like this, or either to state them at the start of a Labour conference, something like that. And people saying, oh, fantastic, you know, this is so great. It's like, it cost him nothing. That cost him absolutely nothing. And he can do whatever he wants after that, even stating things that are slightly more in disagreement with this kind of ideology. It really will cost him nothing later. Whereas for women, that's not the same game at all, for most of them at least. And that's this discrepancy, if you want to be feminist about it, that's ridiculous. And that is, to me at least, very infuriating.
Yeah, it's really interesting what you said about how it's not as if you'd said, I'm 8 months pregnant because I'm a woman.
Exactly.
Like, in theory, at least, yeah. You could agree with them.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was the sense that you were making a little bit of a joke out of what everyone...
of the ritual. You know, yeah.
Somewhat fears at the back of their mind is a funny fantasy.
Exactly. It's the ritualistic aspect of it all, so that if you push too much, becomes a kind of flag.
I was very interested in what you said about how your comments about the struggles that mothers could face in the academia were maybe not taken so seriously as other concerns about the representation of women or other real or alleged underprivileged groups. Why do you think that is from where you stand? What was behind the kind of flippancy with which that was treated?
I think that's, I'm happy you asked this because I'm very tempted to write more on this. But again, this is such a big topic that it's still, even for me, it's still hard to see where's the best entry point. But I guess one of the sad truths is that academia, as many other workplaces, has been open to women, which is good. But as it has opened to women, it has not, again, changed in order to suit their specific needs, at least not enough, in my opinion. And again, in the way that banking, finance consultancy has done, so for example, creating on-site crash, creating schemes so that parents can kind of form committees, et cetera, et cetera. Academy is much, much behind. And in a weird manner, it is still perpetuating the bachelor setting, which is, you know, for a very long time, you party hard, you have friends, you know, and especially Oxford, you do drugs or whatever. Yeah, you have a lifestyle that's not very healthy. For undergraduate students, and then when you continue in academia, you do master, you do DPhil, you do perhaps even a postdoc if you're very, very lucky, you end up more or less in your early 30s. I'm still in my 20s personally, but I, for whatever reason, I did that. But anyway, most people end up in their early 30s already. If you're a man, fine. Like, you're not yet at an age you have to worry about anything, at least biologically speaking. For a woman, that's not the same story. And you need to remember that's just the starting point for you to go further in still precarious conditions, geographically, financially. It means that you need to be able to travel as much as necessary because you need to go from one teaching job to another, one tiny little research post to another. You're paid a misery. And especially in a place like Oxford, you would think, well, this is such a fantastic place. Surely, you're paid with they pay you very well. No, you're paid mostly with prestige. And sorry, but you can't eat prestige, or it doesn't put a roof under your on top of your head. So it's hard for women, I think, to be able to reconciliate their strong desire for research, for truth, for kind of long bespoke learning of truth and dissemination of truth, with building a family, for most of them, not all of them, for most of them. What is quite interesting is that I've seen firsthand experience in my committee of peers in academia and in Oxford in particular, that if culture is really like a tap somehow, that's not the best metaphor for it sometimes, but for this one, it really is. If you open the tap and, you know, you have a committee where young people have children, get married, have children, etc., then it's contagious. Like, more people do the same thing, and I've really seen this in a committee in Oxford where I work, where, you know, one person, two person, three person, and then you have just families just like mushrooming everywhere, and it's fantastic. And then you can organize to have a kind of communal setting where babies can be taken care of, etc., and you can do it so easily because everyone's on board somehow. Even people who don't have children, they're just, you know, we have days where I work at the institute where you have people coming specifically because they know they're going to have all of the children around and they're just love babies, etc. But this works extremely well at the scale of a community, which is why you would expect colleges, which are really much committee-based and people-based, to do the same. And it's not the case. And especially because most of the students, again, are people who party hard, who just want to be, you know, in the moment, in the instant, doing a lot of just partying and doing their studies, and they are in their early 20s. And on top of that, there is the very general setting of a culture that has not, that at least that has less and less through time valorized the idea of being young and having children, crafting your careers and your life around the idea of being a parent, because it's seen as something, oh, for various reasons, I guess, dreadful, economically draining, reactionary or whatever from the past, that people put, you know, later and later in their minds. But especially for women, that's a terrible bet to do, because when you're in your 30s or mid-30s, and let's say suddenly you realize you really do want to have something, it's late. I don't think it's too late, but I think there is a case to be made that, you know, chances have become just incredibly law, and you need to be strategic about it, and perhaps that takes also away the romantic aspect of it all, and perhaps some people are put off by that, but fine. But you can't be, you know, beggars can't be choosers, and the problem is that we have very little discussions about all of that. So I think as your question was really good, it's one chapter to open about why, especially in academia, this is getting so complicated. But as a whole, and again, some people are starting to do that, whether it's again Larry Harrington, Louise Perry, and others, talking about families and talking about how we can care for them is more and more necessary. It's not normal that the UK, one of the greatest countries in the whole world, is not having any single kind of strong policy, family-based policy. Not normal. Why is it that people need to pay dreadful amounts of money to put their children even just at nursery? Not normal either. I don't think that, you know, that there are ready-made solutions here and there. But if you look at other countries that, for example, lower taxes, even just that for women who after two or three children can, you know, are tax-free basically for the rest of their lives, that sounds like a great perk. And I'm not saying this, of course, because I would be interested, but just because it's great. It's good that we have means for people to just have the life, the family life that they deserve. And it's not just for themselves, by the way. If you really want to be materialistic about it, productivity is a big deal. And you need to be able, you know, we talk a lot about pensions at the moment, whether in France, where there are lots of protests against it, against the reform, even in the UK. And yeah, if you want good pensions in the future, you need to have children also. So it's a problem that you can take by different angles, which is why it's hard to find the best one at all at once. But the academic one is particularly striking. And on top of all of that, I think what is painful for me is that the academic world is supposed to be the place of transmitting knowledge. It's supposed to be the place where you make others grow, you share your love for something. And therefore, why don't you start with the family? Why don't you start at home? If you're unable to start where intimacy is at the highest, can you really do it properly, you know, in a public square? Probably. There is, you know, plenty of arguments in favor or against, but I think it's striking to me to see that some of the best teachers I've seen have been able to nurture their vocation for transmission, for teaching, etc., at home first and foremost.
Yeah, that's a fascinating discussion. I think there's a similar problem in journalism, I think, where the nature of the job requires you to be sufficiently elastic with your time and sometimes with your location, that it's really geared towards people who don't have responsibilities, or at least serious responsibilities such as children. I remember I think I pretty much got into journalism because I was always prepared if someone said at 8 o'clock at night, can you write this for me by tomorrow? I didn't really have anything to do, so I would say, yeah, sure. Whereas if I had a bunch of kids I had to put to bed, I would have to say, well, how's next Wednesday?
as I know myself very well, because the number of articles that owe you with a critic is getting through the roof. I completely agree.
But it is, as an editor, it's something I do try to kind of, at the risk of sounding too self-flattering, it's something I try to take into account, because I know that it's not like personal virtue that leads someone to be able to submit on time, at least, you know, necessarily. Sometimes it is just because people have a particular level of freedom, which maybe they won't always want to have, and maybe they shouldn't always want to have.
I think the point you're making in the comparison first between journalism and academia is very true. And to extend that point further, the idea is not to say, you know, academia, of course, it's a very specific thing, but ultimately it points towards the same direction, which is the neoliberal order in which we are is asking more and more for a greater number of jobs and vacancies and whatever to have this flexibility everywhere. It was sold to us as a way to be freer. And to some extent, it's true. You're more free to, you know, organize your days as you see fit, whatever, even, you know, in a day post-COVID in particular, where we can travel and work at distance or do hybrid working, whatever. That's fantastic. But it does come with its own side effects. And some of it is indeed, some people will be able to be flexible because it's just who they are at this point in time. It doesn't mean that later they can't be, but it's just not all the time in your life will you be able to show that degree of flexibility, or do you have the character to do so? And, you know, I've been working four different jobs at a time whilst being pregnant, even after doing some even private tutorials, for example, that of course I can organize as much as I want into my day, but there is only 24 hours in a day. And also if you're ill, as I've been, for example, this past week, and you feel like, you know, your life is going to end and you have to deal with everything at the same time, it becomes catastrophic. So we need to cut a slack for ourselves and say, it's fantastic that we've opened up those new forms of works that has also created new types of working. And that's great, I guess, for most of it. Despite the fact that being an influencer is not a thing. I'm not sure I'm not agreeing with this, but anyway. but it's true that this has been at the detriment of family life in particular. And the enslavement to whether it's academia or forms of journalism or whatever has been really, really the subjugation of the family life to pursuit of other goals, which some of them can be fantastic, but definitely are not helping people having children, having families, etc. And then you can say, well, it's not our goal anymore. Great, but then what's our goal? Is our goal to die as a civilization, to die as a society? Is it to, you know, we need to ask those questions. And somehow the very tough, hard questions are either avoided by people, or when they're not avoided, they are, you know, these questions are labeled already problematic for whatever reasons. It's like, oh, you're traditional reactionary. It's like, well, we need at some point to be able to have an adult discourse. And I think that you know, that ties up slightly into the point of our discussion to start with, which was the article on the idea of women in politics just knee-jerking all the time to this kind of gender ideologies and other progressive ideologies. Is that why is it that we can't have adult discussions about all of this, but always avoid? And, you know, the point of avoidment is good enough. When I think there was 1 or 2 days or even 3 days before Sturgeon resigned, she was unable to answer to that journalist question saying, you know, but you do understand. Yes, of course, she's a woman, that male rapist. But, you know, in that case, you know, it's just, we just can't put her in a female prison. Like, why? And just the unwillingness to answer that question says it all. It's not adult to just say, but you know what I mean. It's like, well, no, I don't know what, you know, words have meaning and you need to say things very plainly. You can't just wink your way out of a very, very problematic question. And the fact that we've accepted that level of political argumentation, or even sometimes journalism argumentation, or even academic argumentation, is dreadful. And I see that in academia all the time. It's like making those non sequitur arguments between one thing to another, taking leaps of faith sometimes from one point to another, saying, oh, trust me, you know, that's for the greater good, or I know what I'm doing, I'm an expert on this, is ridiculous. And I wish more people, especially people who don't have the degrees, you know, there are more and more float currencies anyway, would poke at all of that and say, sorry, but that doesn't make sense. And it's not because I don't have the same degree, but just because this genuinely doesn't make sense, and you should not be paid for doing that, or you should not be greeted and accepted as completely fantastic, brave, and, you know, and whatever other types of adjective you progressive want to throw at that, because just it tallies up very neatly into the ideology that you are preserving or praising. This is just, again, no one has the right to dismantle reality, and everyone has the right, however, to stand against that.
100%. And I want to link that to another article you wrote for The Critic a couple of months ago. This concept, you know, where people feel obliged to talk something up as being noble, honorable, beautiful, which was addressing the link between performance art and activism now. Yeah. It was called Biting the Hand That Feeds Them, I think. And it focused on a campaign where people were basically prancing around in the street holding bottles of urine, which was supposed to make a grand statement against the bigotry of X, Y, and Z. There is this strange compulsion to look at something which I think most people would recognize as just childish and disgusting, mm-mm, and frame it as in kind of grand aesthetic or political terms. Where do you think it comes from?
I have a sense, and I'm very happy to be pushed on this by, you know, people listening and wanting to react. I just have the sense that somehow we've never left the post-war type of rebirth of theatre. So there's been a lot of different trends of theatre coming from after the Second World War. And one of them has been the living theatre, made mostly by people actually on the East Coast in America, where, you know, it's all about, it's less about forms. It's all about just pure direct expressions of things and just like bodies moving into space. And, you know, perhaps at the time that was revolutionary, but it's only radical insofar as it's one reaction against something. And somehow it became a trend. It became an endless state of artistic expression and artistic meaning, which I think is starting to become ridiculous. I think it has been ridiculous for quite some time already, but now that it has been so pervasive into the public square, people are like, what is this? You know, why is it that we just accept this kind of thing? They don't realize, or it takes some time to realize that it's been probably more than 70 years or more that we've just accepted this as a de facto form of valid art expression on theatres, on stage. And I just want to add some nuance. I've been an art critic for many, many years, and I've seen this being done extremely well and extremely poorly. And so there can be room for something very well said and organized. But again, it has its, I think, its place on stage, or if it doesn't have it on stage, at least it has on such better ways to just organize the discourse and the artistic gesture and whatever. And this form of, so I think that the protest I was talking about in particular was a male trans activist who just poured a lot of piss literally in front of one of the major organizations for human rights, something like this, if I remember correctly. And again, in protest of the fact that transgender rights or whatever are not respected, which, to be honest, is at this point, to repeat that mantra, is extremely blind or crazy or both, I don't know. And it's like, why do we accept this as a relevant art form or relevant political discourse or both? Well, it just happens that we've had this in theatres or in theatrical circle for so long that it's just a complete normal outpouring into the public square. And so to start criticizing this means that we need, again, to go back to the roots of that problem. And some of the roots, not all of them, but some of them are the way that the artistic world and the way that, again, we put most of the time public money, by the way, into those projects, those structures, the institutions, programs, and whatever, have been just more and more cannibalized, again, by ideologues. So, you know, you could say, oh, well, it's just a few frantic, whatever, weird people in the street. No, they are completely enabled by a long tradition now. I think we can talk about tradition of making art and making, especially kind of, it's not fully theatre, it's more like art happening, to be honest with you. It's not, I think lots of people in theatre would disagree with the idea of me conflating the two, but I think there is like a weird in-between zone between theatre and just artistic happening, artistic expression altogether that blend in this kind of art form. And yeah, it's it also dovetailed neatly into one of my obsessions of mine. So it's actually a thinker who is not very well known in England, but Philippe Muret, who died in the early 90s, is an incredible thinker, a bit like Lash. Actually, he was someone who came from the left and later became critical of the left, but retaining a lot of kind of post-liberal vibe into all of that. And he talks about the permanent form of festivism, the idea of everything need to be a feast nowadays, you know, in our postmodern world. And it's because you don't buy into the permanent festivism and onirism of it all that you become suspicious of wanting to preserve reality, and reality becomes a thing of the past, and hanging on to reality and truth in the past means that you're more and more kind of has been chatty almost kind of people. And the difference between, again, the way that ideologues put very easily social labels and shameful labels, etc., to detach themselves from what ultimately is necessary and pertinent is very visible. you know, I don't think it's normal to acclaim someone who pours piss everywhere, in the same way that I don't think it's just not enough from critics to say, oh, that's ridiculous. How is that silly? You know, we just feel like it's a, you know, GB News has done a lot of good things or whatever, but the way it has just normalized the criticism of saying it's just a bit silly, isn't it? It's just a bit ridiculous. It's not good enough. You need to address, again, the roots of the problem. And I dread of a world, which is true now, of Andrew Doyle just making political commentary by literally just stating this again and again. Isn't it just silly that Tatiana McGrath has become true? It's like, yeah, fine, but what do we do about that? You know, how are we, practically speaking, countering those facts?
One of those roots that you mentioned in your piece, I think, it's this idea that art can be judged by the kind of impact it has.
Mm-mm-mm.
You know, it's not just about the effect it has on our psyches, on our souls, if you want to use a grand term. And I mean, even the idea that art should be judged by its effect on our emotions or our spiritual life is itself controversial. I mean, doesn't it have some kind of inherent worth which transcends the influence that it has on us? But I think the idea that its impact on the world, you know, what does this say about climate change? How is this helping us to improve, you know, the rights of women? What does this say for Black Lives Matter?
Exactly.
Obviously, spraying urine around is an exceptionally strange manifestation of this impulse. But I do think this impulse is at least one of the roots of it. How would you respond? Because, like, you can see why people believe this. I mean, there are a lot of terrible things in the world that we do want to stop. So, you know, poverty, war.
Yeah.
So you can see how someone could be like, well, what's the point of art if it's not helping us to improve the world? How would you respond to my kind of steel man?
Yeah, I think to be honest, I don't think that art shouldn't talk about things that happen in nowadays lives. I don't think that's the point of what I said, but the criticism was more about the idea that art itself can have a political impact on things, like the audacity that people think that people have in mind that art can be a political weapon. Those examples, when they happen in history, are extremely rare. And I think also happen most of the time in extremely elitist circles. So, you know, if people want to have a very communist vibe to it or socialist vibe to it, or they need to just remind themselves that when art does have an impact in the world, at least on purely historical perspective, most of the time it's really at an extremely elitist level, whether, you know, socially elitist amongst aristocrats, for example, or elitist in terms of just, you know, intellectual close circles. So it's, if we look at even just 19th or 20th century, when it is the case that art can have sometimes of an impact, it's still rare, it's not an exception. And art can express political things. And if anything, I'm actually quite happy that it does so. I'm not very much against that. I just think that it has taken such a very stern dimension in all of this, which is basically being revolutionary, being you know, in disagreement, being against without proposing anything, being against by being, you know, a perpetual state of angriness, that this obsession about this mono discourse is more and more betraying what art is supposed to be about. I don't think art is just supposed to be about beauty. For example, I think some pieces can be just about beauty or transcending any form of political matters. That's fine. If anything, that's even great. But when art does talk about life and not just political things, but life, it's also what art is has to do with anyway. What is quite funny is that, you know, we've lost completely the beautiful artistic rhetoric from the Middle Ages, let's say, with you know, the Wheel of Fortune, the cycle of things about cycles of life, etc., very complex forms of artistic rhetoric that have been completely washed away because they are just too complex, and they are also ingrained with Christianity. And also nowadays, well, that's definitely not correct to revive this kind of art forms. But we could have had an equivalent nowadays, especially during COVID, this idea of death being imposed equally to everyone. Isn't that like the reminder of, you know, profound, even stoic forms of slogans that remind us of our mortal conditions, of our shared human condition, etc. Instead, we've had none of that. We've had none of this. So we are in a state of artistic dryness. And I think this is also very visible with when art does become political, it is extremely level. It doesn't have any depth. It's really like one big emotion being splurged at people's faces, hopefully not piss, but it just not good enough. We can do better, and we ought to do better. And I think that's on a point where many critiques, especially conservatives or whatever, are really, really, really bad at. They need to take the lead about what it is that a good reform of arts world looks like. How does change look like? Today, I cannot count any conservative who is able to say so. And that's sad, because it means you really are falling behind on all of the work necessary to undo some of those tragic, events, ideas, political movements or whatever, and you're not taking the lead on the solutions. Again, the critics cannot stay on, shouldn't feel happy to stay in that sideline on the side benches, just saying this is silly and bad. Yeah, fine, but what are you going to do about this? We need to take active, concrete steps to say this is one solution, whether it's about family, as we were discussing before, about art, about women in whatever state. But we need to stop this kind of self-congratulation. It's not self-congratulation, I can't find the word, but just a state of lethargy, basically, where it's been so good to be again in the back benches and say, I just disagree with that, without articulating a positive image. That doesn't sound cringe, also perhaps that's also the pitfall. On that idea of art intertwined with politics, there is very little that critics can say other than just this is silly, and they we need to go a bit further into all of that. So hopefully I answered that your question, which was really good, by the way, but I've, as always, I drift very far away from the starting point.
No, I think that was a wonderfully challenging and motivational answer. I think it's true that there's a kind of spiral of negativity where the intensely negative and hostile and aggressive political and aesthetic manifestations of the left are answered by the kind of the snide and facetious negative responses of the right. And maybe I'm giving a negative response to that and perpetuating it. But I think you're right to poke people towards a slightly more creative and constructive response, where rather than just critiquing, or not even critiquing, just kind of scoffing at a bankrupt aesthetic and ideological vision, people can try and produce something of their own. Because ultimately, you don't just attract people to your cause by critiquing something. You attract it because you offer them the image of something beautiful in its place. An example I like to think of is the kind of art, the left-wing art and cinema of the 60s, which was very, very critical of the kind of social mores of the time. But it also had these kind of inspiring characters and this beautiful cinematography, and it was its own aesthetic vision as well.
Yes.
On the Road, for example, it's maybe not the best example, because Kerouac was in his own way a bit of a reactionary, but very much against the bourgeois norms of its time, but also very exciting and very invigorating, and you kind of wanted to go out and forge your own path. Whereas if he just said, families pretty bad, aren't they, how boring that is.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't have had the same impact.
No, I completely agree. If I can just add a tiny, as always, a tiny trope commentary on all of that, it's very visible when you look at Netflix nowadays. So for example, some of the big series, Sex Education, for example, sex is great, sex is good, as long as it is not for procreation, it's fantastic. It is said almost word for word like that. People might say, she's again being very amphigoric or whatever, but it's true. It's really, really stated very clearly with you were saying, characters with depth, etc. None of the characters have depth. They are kind of just surface level images of people projecting what the moral discourse they want to see spread is. And at the end of the day, you just watch this saying, okay, so I've been like, again, splurged with this idea that any type of sex is kind of good, but definitely marriage, family, whatever, blah. And it's said so explicitly. It's like we're living in a moralistic world, extremely that just what I find absolutely fantastic is that the creators of such series to not have any sort of remorse, even like just artistic one, to say, oh no, we're definitely going to do that and it's going to appeal to people. And apparently it does. Like, it's not a series that doesn't perform very badly. So also, as an audience, have we turned ourselves to things where we would just want things to be taught to us extremely clearly and articulated, and just being taken by the hand and just, you know, oh, this is what you need to believe? Perhaps we have. And if that's the case, we need to reckon with that and say, as a society, we have failed ourselves. And I think somehow, as sad as it is, it's also somehow better, because we could start articulating what who we are as a society, what is necessary to change or not to change, and just accept the fact that it's not just, you know, one little thing, or you know, the conspiracy theories or whatever. It's just also a social movement that is pervasive to society level. But whatever that is, we need to address those things. And I agree. I don't think the critique has been made well enough.
Hopefully this conversation can be at least one prod in a better direction. Lola Salam, thank you for your extremely incisive and interesting perspectives today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you to the critic for inviting me today.
Thank you.